I want to ask the first question. Have you given them all questions to
answer?
No, I haven't. Oh, okay.
I haven't given him questions, so you can relax. Oh, as far as I thought, some of these guys would be interested in hearing how you met Elizabeth and how you guys, how God brought you guys together, and that story. I thought I've heard it a little on some of the tapes, but I thought they would really be interested in hearing.
Okay, all right. Did you hear some new fellow here?
This is Paul James.
Paul? Oh, hey, Paul.
Paul's a freshman.
Okay.
Freshman.
Seems like everybody's delayed or else taking extended tours. I know what you mean by that. I had been in business and a lot of different things. And then in 1973... I met a pastor in Montreat, North Carolina, Calvin Thielman, who became a very close friend of mine. At that time, I was traveling 14 states in the South and as a manufacturer's representative with ladies' clothing firms. And I had, by that time, thought a lot about Christian work as I was telling Carolyn Teague over here. It's strange with me in that I thought about Christian work before I became a Christian. And I say that because I was always in the church and went to church regularly and had thought about it. But there came a time in life from 1966 on that I kept thinking about maybe doing some seminary work or school work or trying to find a Christian vocation. And in August of 73, I was going to New York City to pick up the new lines of clothing. And I stopped by in Montreat on my way, a week or so ahead of that, and talked to Calvin, told him I was going to New York, and he said, while you're in New York, he said, Boston is only about an hour flight. Catch a shuttle and get a car, go out and look at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. And I have a friend up there who's a professor, and he'll show you around. And he said, I think you ought to think about going. And if you can get in, even if you only go for a year, it won't do you any harm. If you go back into secular work, it'll give you a year of seminary training, give you an opportunity to learn a little bit in the Bible and do some studying, and you can go back to work, or you might wind up doing something else. So I told Calvin that I would, and I did. I went up, looked at the seminary I spent a day up there, day and a night, I guess, came back down, and came home to Atlanta, called the school, and I said, you know, what are the possibilities of coming in? And they said, well, the committee had already closed for the year. So the Doug Stewart, who was the registrar up there, said, well, you can come up if you want to audit for half a year and then apply and get in. I said, I think I will. And I called New York and told firms that I wasn't going to go out on the road again and got rid of that business. Rented out my house in Atlanta, which is a little odd story in how little faith one can have. I came back from New York and I was sitting in the living room praying about what to do, whether I ought to sell the house or rent it. And while I was doing this, thinking and praying about it, came a knock on the door. Guy stood outside the door and said, I see this house. Nobody lives here. And I said, yeah, I live here, but I said, I'm not around too much, just on weekends. He said, well, I drive by every morning. I just wonder if you'd rent it. And I said, oh, no, I don't know about that. I don't know if it's for rent. Boy, I was backtracking so fast. Actually, I wound up renting to the fellow, but afterwards I thought about it. I said, how in the world can you sit down and pray and get an obvious answer and then say no? I said, that's terrible. Anyhow, I went up in September of 73, arrived at the school when they had Addison Leach, who was a professor up there. They had his casket in the chapel. And I was there for the funeral. And that gave me about 2 nights to live in the dormitories, and that was 2 nights too many. And I decided I got to get off this place. Went looking for a house and to live in a room. I found a place, and the lady said, "Well, can you wait till Wednesday, till Sunday to move in?" And I said, "Well, I suppose so." I said, "I'll take it. I'll come Sunday." I got back to school on Wednesday, and one of the profs there said to me, "By the way, Mrs. Leach is looking for a boarder. Are you interested? Have you found a place?" I said, "Well, I found a place, but I'm still, if it's nearer to school, I'd just soon go there," which it was. So I went down and interviewed with Mrs. Leach and moved in the next day. That was 2 days after. Well, I met her before her husband was buried, and I moved in there, I guess, the day of his funeral, or maybe it was the day after his funeral, and lived there for 2 years before I got kicked out. And, you know, for some of you who might not know who Mrs. Leach is, Mrs. Leach was also Mrs. Elliott. So she was my landlady for 2 years. And the reason she kicked me out, she said, you know, they couldn't be having this emotional, romantic situation under the same roof with the landlady. I mean, you just can't live that way. So that's the only time I guess I got mad with her, because she did it in a poor way. I mean, when she told me to get out, I sat her down and talked to her. The part of the story that's really remarkable is the fact that the student that moved in, we were two of us living there, the student that moved in first was Walt Shepherd. And Walt married Valerie, the daughter. And then I married Elizabeth. So it often happens when she's speaking on the suffering and loss, or as you said, transfiguration of experience, the fact that out of suffering comes new life, or out of death comes new life. And it was surely shown in this, because not even thinking about my own situation, but her daughter would not have had the husband that she has if her husband hadn't died. And there was no way that Walt would have ever met Valerie except through the death of one. So, you know, it's something to think about when things happen in your life, which they will eventually, something will happen. That if you can see that out of something that you think is a wreck or a real trial, something good will come. I think that has to be, well, at least the Christian, I think, sees it. The non-Christian would think in those terms. Anyhow, that's how we met. A little bit unusual.
You know, just kind of related to that, I'll let these guys loose in a second, but one question that I'm always asked is, Ralph, how do you know that Pam was the right gal, you know? Or, and I was just wondering, how was it that you knew that Elizabeth was the right woman for you? How was it that the two of you were able to decide then together that marriage was the right thing for the two of you?
Well, now, we didn't decide together.
Okay.
One thing we didn't do is we didn't talk about marriage at all. There came a time, I mean, I think she was suspicious. In fact, afterwards, she had been with someone and had told this person that there's a man who I think is planning to ask me to marry him. And she went and got some counsel and, you know, talked about the situation to this person. But we never I mean, I never joked about marriage. I never talked about it. I think that's a real pitfall to talk about marriage, because I think sometimes people wind up getting married through talking about it and say, well, we've talked about it so much that the guy says, how can I back out now? If I back out now, I'm going to shatter this woman. I think it has to come from the man. You know, there are certain things, and I don't think that they're so very spiritual, at least mine. There wasn't a whole lot of spiritual aspects involved in deciding to marry her. I mean, granted, I think you're looking for a Christian woman. A Christian woman ought to be looking for a Christian man. Beyond that, and I think, again, it goes to, for instance, in a seminary situation where you've got a lot of Christians together, male and female. Part of a problem that comes out of marriages, I think, in that kind of a situation, is the fact that they've only seen each other in church, at seminary functions, and in that kind of thing, but they don't know whether one of them likes to go mountain climbing and the other is a bookworm, or if, you know, one is, you can take all the different opposites. The first time, it took me about 6 months to realize that this woman knew how to appreciate a man. She's a woman who will let a man do things for her, and I think that's important. You know, I open up the door for her, and I still do. We're at home alone, the two of us. I'll pull the breakfast chair out and seat her. You know, she's insignificant, maybe, but I think it's important from the standpoint of saying that I care enough about you to do this. And it doesn't hurt the man, it doesn't make him any less strong, and it doesn't make the woman weaker by accepting it. So I saw this in her, and I had, you know, living under the same roof, in a sense, and being part of the Sunday dinner and all, even though she told both of us, Walt and myself, you know, what to do, and as far as washing the dishes, and we'd scrub the floor and cut the grass and do things around the house, and we had things to do, and if my bureau got too dusty, I'd find a note written in it, please dust, you know, and, you know, which was fine. I enjoyed that. You know, I think after a while I just let dust accumulate to see if she'd write the note to me and all. But, you know, we went out. I used to take her to movies, or we'd go out for dinner, and sometimes we'd take a ride up toward the mountains. And I found a lot of things. She says that my imagination has gone way downhill since we got married. I mean, I had a great imagination before marriage, because I was always thinking. I had one thing in mind, you know, what can I think up that would be nice to do with her? And that's how I would put it that way. So I think companionship. I enjoyed sitting in on a Sunday afternoon, if we had the fire on in the fireplace and she would be reading or something. I enjoyed being in the same room, not talking necessarily, but just being there with her. I can feel comfortable without having to entertain her. And so we had that part. I think it's important to think about that. Will I be happy spending silent moments with the person, you know, rather than do I have to continually do things? If you have to continually do things with a woman to keep her sort of occupied and you occupied, then you are not enjoying each other. You know, and it's a little bit of both. Because I think that, especially for young people, I think the if you're from different churches, I think it's important to find a church that you can belong together. You know, because if you get married, you're going to wind up having children, unless the Lord sees fit not to give you any. But I don't think that you can say, well, we're not going to have children, because children's part of children is part of a Christian family. So that you need to find a place where you can both go if you're from different denominations, just for the sake of the children. I don't know, what else? Help me out there, Ralph.
Said she was a woman who appreciated a man.
Yeah.
Companionship, church background.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some things that.
Yeah, and also that you, along with the companionship, you also have to have that thing of, do you enjoy the same things? And if not, that's not an impossibility. But if, for instance, I enjoy fishing. Well, I don't think she's fished one time in her life, and I don't think that she'll ever will. But that's fine. But you have to then say that I'll enjoy my fishing when I have the opportunity, and I've had her, go down and watch me for a while or something like that. But I know that she's not going to stay around, hang around, watching for me trying to get a fish out of the water. But you have to then be free enough so that that's all right. You know, she can do whatever she wants to do with that period of time that I'm down there and all. And likewise, if she has a little friend she used to get together with for a little lunch bunch, you know, well, I'm not a part of that, and that's fine. But you do need things that you enjoy, simple things that you enjoy doing together. I don't know. Did anybody else want to pop in here? I'm sure I've missed something.
So, the question, you know, how do you know that?
Well, okay, then the question, all right, so when you've got all of those things together, I think the man then, rather than talking about it, and that's, I'm real strong on that as far as, you know, we know people who say, well, we've been talking about getting married. I say, that's for the birds. I think at one point, the man has to say, all right, these are the likes and the dislikes. Here's where we can, you know, we've found that we enjoy each other, and this is what we agree on and disagree on. And then the man has to say that this is the woman that I would like to spend the rest of my life with. And then you make the commitment. And then I think you need to go to the girl and say in no uncertain terms that I love you, or I am the man who would like to take care of you for the rest of your life. I'd like to marry you. And then the girl has the opportunity of saying yes or no. I think that may have gone, I don't know, it may have gone out of style. I think the man should go to her parents. You know, they don't do that very much anymore, from what I understand. I think the man has a responsibility to go to the father and say, I'm in love with your daughter. You know, may I have your permission to marry her? And after all, she's part of his family. Granted, he can't stop anybody, but it's always good to have a blessing from the parents. They're going to be your family. And, marriage, I'm sure you know that. Marriage is a whole lot easier if you get along with in-laws. Unless you're going to be a half a whirl away or something. But that's the thing. I think, and then at that point, you make the commitment, and then you forget about, you know, Jane or Sarah or somebody else that you sort of have as a pal. I mean, then you've got an engagement period, and then you settle on her and make your final plans for marriage. And I think that I just, not too long ago, had, well, not, where was it? saw the other day in Portland. A real nice fellow. He asked me if I could have some time with him after the meeting, and he was saying, you know, he said, I don't have any of these lovey feelings, but he said, I've been going with this girl for some time, but do you need that? Do you need to have feelings of being in love? And I said, I don't think that the feelings are as important as the fact of, can you show that you love her and taking care of her, of wanting to be with her, of protecting her, of providing for her, so that once the decision has been made to get married, or that this is the one for you and you've asked her, then I think you can take over, look over the chapter in 1 Corinthians, and then you find out that this is what you're promising to do. You know, that there isn't anything much said about the feelings, you know. They're great if you have them. I think every young person ought to have them. I mean, you do. I remember going out as in my college days, and goodness, I fell in love one time for 2 weeks, and it was my best buddy's girl. He went to Canada, and I fell in love. He came back, and he didn't like it. That's great, but it wouldn't have been a basis for marriage. It'd have been terrible. So I think at the end, when you decide to do it, then you have to consider too, this, you know, that God brings you together, that you pray about it, that's not out of it. No, I think part of that too, that you're not going contrary, absolutely contrary to the will. I don't believe that there's just one girl for one man. You know, I don't think that a lot of women think that way. If they don't get married to John, well, there'll never come another one down the pike. I think God has a person chosen. However, if the circumstances are such that that particular marriage doesn't take place, I think there's another one that God will provide. The same way as jobs. I don't think that there's necessarily one job for one person.
Say, for instance, you do ask a woman to marry you, and she, instead of saying yes, says no. Is that God's way of saying this is not the one for you?
Well, I think it could be.
I mean, it seems it's just a basic question. I mean,
yeah.
If, you know, this, then what?
Well, I think it could be. I think that a man has to be man enough to realize that, and it's, you know, no doubt you're going to get your feelings crushed. Nobody wants to be refused or rejected if you decide that this is the woman for you and she says no. It's going to make you feel terrible. You know, it's like asking for a date, and even more so, you know, I used to walk around by the telephone for a half hour sometimes when trying to screw up my courage to ask some girl out and then be told no, you know, and I said, oh, well, I knew it, you know. I was devastated. But why not? That certainly could be the answer. And at that point, I think you'd have to leave hands off. I don't think that you can persuade a girl and say, well, why not? You know, she has her reasons. She doesn't have to give them to you. I think that's it. How many? I'm curious in a sense. How many of you, when you go out, though, when you go to pick up the date, do you go up to the door and, you know, bring her down to the car? Do you open the car door for her? And, you know, see her in a restaurant, if you're going out to eat, and it's kind of a situation, I mean, if it's a booth, you don't move the booth. No. Do you do the little things that you can do? Do you help her on with a coat? Help her off with it? And I think it's very important. You know, I don't want to embarrass any of you by saying raise your hands or something, but if you don't do it, you ought to think about it. because that's an opportunity for you to be a servant. And you'd be surprised what it'll do for your ego. That you do it, whereas other, I think in a good sense, it impresses. Say for instance, if you go to a restaurant, if you're going out for, and this is your big night out of the year, whatever the celebration might be, and if you're going to a nice restaurant, properly, the woman is not supposed to do the ordering. Now a lot of the women don't know that. You don't have to tell her that. Look. You ninny, you don't know enough about that. But you could say, well, what would you like? May I have your order before the waiter comes? And then when the waiter comes, you can say, my friend will have, and you can rattle it off and then give your order. And, it impresses a woman just immensely. They just think that, your goodness, you're taking care of me. I don't have to do a thing. Yeah. Of course, not if you're divvying up the check. Don't
tell them how you proposed to Elizabeth. I thought that was very interesting what you told her.
Well, I don't know if I can even say it anymore. It's the only time in my life, I guess, that inspiration ever struck. We were at, I had stopped off, she was, it was in June, and she used to go down to Cape Cod to write in June. And I was coming from New York going to Boston, and I drove by to see her, have dinner and all. And we were sitting in the room, and I prefaced it by saying that I would, like to be the one that would build a fence around you and stand on all sides to protect you. And I didn't know it at that time that it impressed her, but it landed me in an article, I think. But she said that's what did it. The fact that up until that time, she had been, as I said, she had been suspicious that I was going to pop the question to her. Up until that time, I think she was weighing her, life as it was at that time, her ministry, what the change would be for her and both of us, I guess. And then, I don't think she had totally made up her mind. Now, she didn't leap up and say yes. She said, at that point, you might say that at that point, when I had asked, and we might have had 5 minutes conversation, we didn't have any, a little longer, I guess probably maybe talk 15, 20 minutes about it. And I think she asked me, why, or how did I come about to thinking that way? And, but she did say, I will think about it. She said, I can't give you an answer tonight, but I'll think about it. Which was fine with me. I said, that's fine. I was not pushing. In fact, I told her it took 2 weeks, and I got a letter from her accepting the proposal. And I told her afterwards, I said, goodness, you shocked me. I said, this was June. I figured I was going to have to wait till August or September. I thought, she'll think about it over the summer. Maybe that shows you how little I know of a woman's mind. But she said that was a good definition of what a man is supposed to do for a woman. Now, as I said, I've not lived up to all those that statement. In fact, we were down in Dallas. It was in Arizona. She has a real good friend of hers who's crippled by polio, and we were down there. We were going to go out for a movie one night, and Jan and my wife and We're all sitting in the, driving up to the place. I get to the parking lot. I parked the car, and I got out, and for some reason, I just started walking off, heading for the movie. I don't know what I had on my mind or anything. Here, poor Jan is on crutches. You know, she can walk, but she has a tough time getting in and out of a car. So Jan got unscrambled and out of the car, and all of a sudden I heard her hollering, "Hey, Lars, where are them dead burn fences you're building?" So I came back and I said, "Oh," I said, "I don't know what I was thinking of." You know. But it's funny.
That's a good definition. I really like it. Mr. Grimm, yeah. Going back to the thing you said just a moment ago, what do you do when you're with a girl that does not receive, like you opening the door or opening the chair or whatever? And a lot of girls around here are like that. They're uncomfortable.
Yeah, I hate that word, uncomfortable with it. I've had it happen to me. I had it happen to the seminary. You know, I opened up, I happened to get to the door when some girl was coming up. I opened the door, and she did go through, but then turned around, and she just blasted me with all sorts of questions about why I did it and all that. I think if you have one particular one in mind, in other words, if it's a girl that you're interested in or going out with or something, I think you have to just go very easy with her, and maybe over a period of time you can explain to her that, you know, you realize that she can open up the door, it's not that, but that you would like to show her that you kind of would like to take care of her a little bit. You'd like to do little things for her. There's not much you can do. You know, you're not married. The relationship between what a man and a woman can do outside of marriage, as far as, you know, things together or in showing, you know, you can't just go out and buy clothes, so you can't go out and buy things for them. Well, at least, I don't know, it used to be that way. Certain things you can buy, certain things you can't buy. And you're not, you know, if she's living in an apartment, you're generally not going to come over and fix the plumbing or do odd jobs like you do for your wife. You're not going to wash her dishes or something. So it comes down to the little bitty things that you can do. Courtesy. And if you could get it across to her that all you're trying to do is to be courteous. And if you can get it across to her that by her accepting it, she makes you more of a man. And I think you would find this. I don't know how many of you, you know, do you sense that when you have done something for a woman, when you've helped her, or do you feel like you are more of a man? I think you should. And unfortunately, the women have been just taken with this stuff about they're the weaker sex, or that they're beneath men, or the feminist movement. All of it has kind of made them real scared of accepting something from a man, thinking that it's going to make them less a woman, when in fact it makes them more a woman. But I think it would take education, you know, soft, real soft. Now, when I courted Elizabeth, I was real easy, because I knew she'd been through a lot, and I didn't come on. It took me 3 years, I guess it was, to really know that this was going to happen. And I think with a woman who is finds it hard to accept something, little thing, little courtesy from a man, you can't change her overnight. But I think you need to explain to her that you're not trying to put her down. You're not trying to. You know that she can open the door. You just want to show her a little bit of courtesy. Oh, what do you think?
I think that's very good. I think that's wise, taking time with a girl like that and then being able to explain it. That's a real wise thing.
And you don't want to make fun of them. So that's no good either. Speaking, and she's signing autographs, and it's her books, and it's the Elliot name, and people call you Mr. Elliot. Now, I tell them this, I'm the third guy, you know, third Mr. Elliot. So, what does that do to your feelings? I don't think I have, you know, if you worry about it, I think maybe you could conjure up some sort of feelings that way. But I think the person who starts worrying about self-image in a situation is digging himself a hole. And I don't think you can be natural and worry about self-image. If you're worried about self-image, then you're on a stage acting. And the thing with Elizabeth is that I look at her, and she has lived through some experiences that I know nothing about. Now, even if I memorized her talks, I can't get up there and give them out. They're not mine. I could tell about them, and I knew her. She has earned her place. And I think one of the things that I've always enjoyed about her is the fact that she is genuinely surprised when people tell her that a book has meant something to her, or that the talk was something that they needed, that she has been able to minister to them. She is, I would say, she is generally the... I don't know if the pessimist would be the word. She's not pessimistic, but she's of the opinion that if somebody's going to have the blame for something, she'll wind up with the blame. It's that kind of an attitude, and she's always conscious of her limitations. Well, that's her ministry. And when I look at my life, I've been in sales off and on all my life, and I've traveled, not selling to people every week, but rather two or three times a year. Well, it really has prepared me to be help me in what I'm doing now, because more than likely, most of us will not meet again after this weekend. We might have an opportunity to see each other in a year or two or something at another place. So that for me, for handling the business end and the sale of books and tapes, I've got to be able to go in and meet people. And I never even thought of myself as a salesman, a hard salesman, or anything like that. I just enjoy meeting people and being with people. And so it has worked in. That part of it is what I can do. I can't stand up on a platform and tell her story, but I can increase the ministry that she has through other means. And I enjoy listening to her. I think she's great. I enjoy the way she tells her story and her sense of humor and everything about it. And if we were on the road every day of the year, I don't think I'd ever get tired of hearing her story and the incidents that happened to her, all that. What I appreciate, she doesn't mind telling a story on herself, and I think that's very important. So as far as feeling inferior to her, I don't. I think I know what I can do. I do know what I can't do. And that's a help.
I think is what I'm hearing you say is that you can rejoice with the gifts and the experiences that God has given you, and you can accept what God has not given you.
Yeah.
Going back to the same thing of trusting God who has put you together with your gifts and your experiences.
Yeah. And I don't know how many times people that have been with her before we were married and now, and I've had a lot of people come up and say, you know, this since you've been married and since you've been traveling together, she has, well, improved, it's not a good word for it, but her response to people and her interaction with people have it's become better, and you know, she has changed and for the better, and I have helped in this way, I guess, from what the people say. And it's also what she said, you know, she's been married 3 times, and she says God gives different gifts to get different men. And this was one of the basis that she decided on marriage, because she has always felt she was a one-man woman. And she read the verse in the Bible that, you know, that men have different gifts, but it's the same giver. And I'm not quoting it complete, but it's the same giver that gives, you know, liberally to all. And she said there are things that, you know, Jim Elliot could do for her that Ad Leach and I can't do. Other things that Ad Leach could do that the other two couldn't. And I have gifts that I can put into operation for her that neither one of the other two could. So that it is, you know, that is it. And if you're secure, I think if you're secure within the boundaries of your limitations, then that will make you a person that probably will not have to worry about inferiority or low self-image or whatever. We had an interesting conversation with a doctor not long ago, a friend of ours who was in psychiatry, and he's now a GP, saying that psychiatry is really a dead-end street. And he was talking about this low self-image, and we were asking, what do you say to somebody when they say, well, so-and-so has a low self-image, and you couldn't tell him anything because you would destroy him either further in low self-image. And this doctor said that, he said, it's very simple. I can tell you what a low self-image is. He said, a low self-image is sin. And, no, and he explained it this way. He said, I can show it, and he could show it to the front of the Bible. But he said, low self-image is spelled pride. Because the person with a low self-image is saying, really, I deserve better than what I have. Or I deserve better than what I got. So then God has given each of us, you know, different personalities, different gifts, different circumstances. You name it. I don't know how broad can we make the differences between individuals. And he just said that when you look at what you have and say, well, I really don't have much and my self-image is not very high, the real factor there is that your pride is hurt because you've not been given what someone else has. And that's, you know, it's really something to think about. So, you know.
Kind of along the same lines, in what ways do you leave Lisbon spiritually?
Yeah, okay. Want to know how I lead Lisbon spiritually. That's a tough one. Not that I really haven't thought about it, and because spiritually, she is way, way, way in the forefront of me. You know, she has walked through fires that I don't know anything about. She's also spiritually minded. she sees everything in terms, everything around her. You know, when she looks at the stars and the moon, and she looks at the trees, the wildlife, and all, she looks through that into a spiritual realm. Me, I look at the stars and the birds. You know, I just don't think that way. And when it comes to the Bible, you know, she has a tremendous knowledge. I mean, she, as she says, she can't really quote chapter and verse, but I can pretty much be sure that if you went up to her and said something from Scripture, she could fill, you know, in on either side, or she could talk to you about it. And I can't. I don't know how many times she's read through the Bible. And I've had the terrible habit of, when I do read the Bible, just sort of opening the Bible and reading it. I think this, when was it I started? I read through the Bible in seminary, but on my own, just this, in January? I guess this fall. Anyway, I got a hold of a NIV version, and I started reading, I started a New Testament. I've been reading just chapter after chapter just to go on straight on through. So that if I was to say that I was leading her or feeding her spiritually, I really don't have the ability, the knowledge to do that. In the mornings, we read the Daily Light and we pray together. So that there's a point when, you know, I read the Daily Light, and generally we don't necessarily both pray, but I always pray. She would say, I think, that in the family I would be the spiritual leader. Not from the standpoint maybe that I give her so much insight, but rather that in the realm of the Christian marriage, I am the leader. So I, little thing like prayer before a meal, you know, I do that if we have people in, or something in that sense. I don't know if that's what you were thinking about in that terms, but, and I would think probably, it, you know, I don't know how many of you are real students of the Bible. Perhaps if we had a like number of women from upstairs down here, maybe we would also find out that the women had something up on us as far as knowledge of the Bible and spiritual a spiritual grasp of it. It shouldn't be this way. I think there's a sense in which a woman, from her being, you know, of knowing life, there's, when they say there's no difference between male and female other than the biological, that's a lot of nonsense. Just think of the fact that a woman who can, think of a woman from the sense of going through childbirth, of she, in just that, realizes, has a deeper scope of what life is than a man. You know, I think that she would have a sense of the mystery of life much more than a man. And when you put that into Christian terms, she would also have a sense of the greatness and the awe of life and what God has given in life.
Didn't you also say that one thing I heard you saying there is that spiritual leadership is like taking initiative in prayer, in devotions? Probably, I would imagine also, spiritual leadership comes in taking the initiative in decision making.
Yeah.
When it applies to the two of you.
It's outside, yeah. Outside of the Bible and prayer, I would say that it would go over the whole area of your married life. I didn't think about that. I was thinking mainly from the standpoint of just scripture and prayer and all, but that would be true. There isn't any question in my mind. Now, that's another thing, that talking about inferiority and having your wife stand up on a platform. But there's never a doubt in my mind that she knows that within the context of our marriage, that I am her head. And I think she may have mentioned this last night. I don't know if she did, but she'll probably mention it tonight. That whole thing is I think, a thing of attitude. You know, you can't list down six or seven things saying, well, here are six ways in which I'm head of my wife, or six ways that she submits to me. But the whole thing is really an attitude. And if the attitude is right, then the reality of that is carried out in the man giving everything he has for his wife. I mean, the man, we're supposed to lay down our lives for our wives. I don't know, can you say that in plural? I guess we can, when, as long as it's not the same man generically. Our life for our wife.
Yeah.
You know, in the same manner that Christ gave his life for the life of the church. And we don't do that. You know, as I said last night, you get mad. Who do you get mad at? You get mad at your wife. You blow up at her when you ought to be loving her. And that's our nature within us that still comes out. We do the good that we don't do, and the things we don't want to do, that's the very things that we try, you know, we do. But the attitude of thinking that I want to do my best for her, and she in turn is trying to lift up and build up her husband. And I've never heard her say anything in public that would have embarrassed me, to anybody. I can't think of any time that she has tried to, knock me down, or when you're out in company and some guy is a tremendous man around the house to doing odd jobs, and you get a wife who says, well, why can't you be like John over there? Look how lucky Mary is to have John. See how he's fixed up this place, and you know the mess that you've left around our place. I mean, she's never played that game. And that's part of the attitude that you have. Yeah, I sure do. She does too. She's a terrible tease, but I think I'm worse. And we have a lot of times in public. I hope it never comes across like we're, at each other or something. But I'll say things. I'll say a little thing that will trigger a story. That's a story about me, or something. Well, and for instance, this morning, at that meeting we had, I said, well, tell the folks how I listened to your advice. Well, I guess some people would think that's either demeaning or that it would shatter the ego or something. But I enjoy that. I enjoy her telling stories about things that I do. This was a situation that I forget what it was about, but I came up from downstairs in I got my basement office in the basement, and I came up, and I said, now, darling, I said, look, I really want your opinion on this. I got to make a decision. I said, I think I know what I'm going to do. But I really want you to tell me what you think. And if you tell me that what I'm going to do is just absolutely asinine, I'll probably go ahead and do it anyway. You know, so, I don't know why I asked her for advice or something, but, and I can't, I don't know what it was about. But it, things like that, you know, it's, we do, we have a lot, I think we have a lot of fun together. Well, I wouldn't tease on anything that would hurt. You know, I think teasing is fine. If you can't do it really in public a lot of times. You can tease about things in private that you can't tease about in public. Because if you do it in public, you're allowing people to maybe see a portion of your private life that ought to be private. You know, there's always that fact about, I wish I could think of an example, these little things that husbands and wives say to each other around a common dinner table with six other people. And there's always that double, you know, double thing. Is she teasing or is she putting a knife in? You know, or is he teasing her? That you have to be careful about. And for instance, if there's something, you know, she hadn't got 1 ounce of ability in any sports. She went to a school where they taught her how to play baseball. No, the school she went to in the fourth grade had baseball in the fifth grade. She transferred to another school. They had baseball in the fourth grade. So when she came in the fifth, she made it. Never had any instructions in baseball, but she had to play. So it went without saying that she was always the last one picked. And when she came up to bat, she was going to strike out. Everybody knew she was going to strike out. So what did she do? She struck out. She lived up to the expectations of the crew people. Now, it would be terrible for me if I went and started teasing her about her non-ability in sports. Or knocked her about that kind of stuff. You know, that's not teasing. That's what is it?
Backstabbing.
No. So that you don't. You want to build people up. You don't want to knock them down. You know, we all. You know, we all have our things that we can do and can't do. We have our strong points and our weak points, and what we want to do is to bring out the strong points and, if anything, overlook the weakness of our brother. Not, you can acknowledge it, and you can try to help him do something about it, but you don't want to strengthen the weakness or try to reinforce the fact that he has one. I don't know if that helps you a little bit on that or not. Or if you had something more specific in mind.
I don't know how to verbalize. One thing that I noticed from here is an awful lot of teasing. I'm not sure, I don't see that much malicious teasing, but I've always been curious as to, like you said, to build
people. How do you tease? How do you
build somebody up when you tease?
You know, well,
how do you just guard that she doesn't know
something
without just not doing it?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a limit to it too. You know when you've reached a limit, and if you don't go beyond that,
probably a good principle on that is, if in doubt, don't.
Yeah. I think that.
I mean, I've learned the hard way.
Yeah, you do. We all do. I wonder what. I don't know. I suppose some of us enjoy teasing more than others. I think one thing, if you tease, you better be sure you're able to take it. If a person can't take it, you know, a lot of people, they can dish it out, but boy, they can't take it. And that's bad. I think sometimes we try to say something teasingly, and when we don't have the, I don't know, call it courage, or when we don't have the strength in the sense to say it straight. I suppose if we went back to the scripture or to loving as we ought to love, then we could solve a lot of those little things that we do in a teasing manner. It's hard. I don't think you have any. There's no set rule for it. As you say, you have a lot of it around here. Why? I don't know why you, why it would be that way.
I think if you can't laugh together, if you can't enjoy laughing together, then there's, I'm not saying you have to be clowns, but I think there's something wrong, even in a ministry. You know, when you just can't laugh together. But there is a danger.
Not only laugh together, I think laugh at yourself. That's when I needed Elizabeth. There's a scripture verse that speaks about making a sane estimate of your own capabilities. And also not to take too high an opinion of your own importance. And I think that's really, at times, I think that's what we do. You know, we really do take ourselves too seriously. And if we would be able to laugh at our mistakes, and it would avoid hurt feelings, it would make easier communications, you know. That's another thing that I feel like I'm quoting my wife here all the time. Another thing that she brings out, that God must have also had a tremendous sense of humor. I don't know who said that, but there was something out of one of the books that you, in looking, when you look at, if you're the kind of person who can see creation and animals and the created animals, when you look at some of them, they are rather humorous, just in their, in the way they are created. So that if we could see that humor, and then not to take ourselves too seriously. So I found out, I don't know if any of you ever think that you're going to make the history book. Do you have that aspiration? I mean, I did when I think I went through a midlife crisis when I was 30 or something, 29. Up until that time, when I went through school and Navy and a few other things, I always thought that there's bound to be the thing that I'm going to be able to do that's going to put me into a history book. Or they'll remember me. And then I got to about 29 and I decided that, you know, the chances are very slim that I'll be in that history book. You know, it's just, I'm more than likely, I hope I lead a productive life and a good life and help people and do things, but, you know, I'm probably not going to do it. And that lessened the pressure for me considerably. But I didn't know if that still is a thing. I think it's good, you know, we want to have aspirations, isn't it? We want to have goals that we set. At the same time, as Christians, we need to look at what it tells us about ourselves in the book. And making a sane estimate. I think that's great. It is. You know. Here you go.
Anyone else have a question?
I was remembering something, I think, Martin John that said last year when he spoke to us about husband and wives having traits that complement each other that are actually different, and they seem like they wouldn't work out, but in God's plan of things, they fit together real well. I was wondering what kind of traits y'all have that fit in like that.
Well, I can sure tell you some traits that are different. I mean, my wife's a reader for one thing, and I'm not. Reading for me is a real struggle. My wife's a thinker, and man, I get one thing on my mind, and it's loaded. So, I don't know. You know, there is a process to thinking, and I'm just not keyed to it. I like to go out, and when I think of something to do, I go out there and I work, and I'd like to work with my hands or do things. She can sit and contemplate, and I don't think I've done that one time in my life, really. But it's not a problem with us. You know, she reads, I read, you know, and She's a person who in a social situation, she is will not come on strong in a social situation when we go out someplace or with people. I'm always trying to kind of help her to get out just a little bit further into her circle of people. She would rather stand kind of off in the corner someplace. Now, I'm the other way around. I just, from the sales background, when I come into a situation, I just soon get on in there with the people. But now that's been a real complimentary situation because it makes social situations easier for her with me there also. I don't know of any other. I can't think of any particular other traits other than that. I think two people can be alike, or they can be, you know, not at all similar, and still can have a happy marriage if they take the commitment seriously, and if they follow what it says in the Bible about a Christian marriage. I just believe that you have to work on it. You have to be willing to work on it. And I don't know if there's any. Ralph, you've had an easy marriage, haven't you? Have you ever had any problems?
Gosh.
I'll tell you, I'll give you one thing, though, and I'm not. Boy, I haven't reached perfection in this thing either. This, you know, talk about in Scripture about don't let the sun go down on your wrath.
Yeah.
And when I get mad, my temper can just fly up to an exploding point for no good reason at all. And there have been occasions when I've gotten upset and I've gotten mad at Elizabeth, and I've gone to bed, and not, you know, generally I'm asleep in about a minute and a half, but I've stayed awake for 10-15 minutes, knowing that I was wrong, and saying, "Boss, you ought to tell her you're sorry," you know, and you can just feel tension. I mean, it's in the air. You can feel the tension. You're in the same room. You know, you can feel the tension.
Even in the same
room. And without a light. You know, it's dark in the room. There's no light in the room. No sound. You know that she's not asleep. And you can feel the tension. and I'll
to each other.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, if you know, at least about that much space or so between, you know, and I'll say, you know, to myself, I said, Lars, you're wrong. You know, why not just reach over and touch her and say, I'm sorry. And I have gone to sleep many a time and wake up in the morning again feeling sorry. And of course, by that time, then now your pride comes in, see. It's going to be much harder to go and say, look, I'm sorry about last night. If you can just do it instantly when you know you're wrong and when you know that you've sinned is what it amounts to. And how in the world we can go against not only our own husband or wife or something, but, you know, go against God. And it is God's command that we should do that. And I've done that. So if I can give anything, you know, a few people enter marriage sometime, if you'd remember that, I think it could be a great help just to, you know, take it upon yourself to even at times when you know you might not be wrong, make the first move for reconciliation, and it goes a long way to making a strong marriage. It's little things like that, I think, that can, you know, split people and explode them.